The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The orders of the court are posted in the clerk's office and outside and available for your inspection. This morning we have three causes to be submitted on oral argument. In the order in which they are presented, they are as follows. Tracy L. McCraw and Lena J. Wiggins and others versus Jimmy L. Maris from Dallas County. Foremost Paving, Inc. and Mother All Contractors, Inc. versus Rosario Lopez, individually and his next friend for Adan and Patricia Lopez from Jim Wells County. And Janet Sumate, individually and as administratrix of the estate of Miranda Gilley versus Fogle Limited and others from Tarrant County. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these causes, but we will complete the arguments in all three causes before we break for lunch. Counsel on the second and third causes do not have to remain in the courtroom, but we ask that you remain nearby so that we may proceed to your matter without delay. These arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. You may apply to the clerk to listen to the tapes of these arguments if you so desire. In the first cause, the court is allowed 15 minutes for each side to present oral argument. Petitioners may reserve whatever amount of time the petitioners wish for rebuttal. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in McCraw versus Maris.
May it please the court, Mr. Gary Sibley will present argument from the petitioner.
May it please the court. My name is Gary Sibley and I'm here on behalf of the petitioners. This case concerns entitlement to the proceeds of a federal government employee's life insurance policy. Donna Ann Maris died, leaving two orphan children and an estranged husband. The principal asset in her estate was the proceeds of this life insurance policy. After Mrs. Maris's early death to cancer, a search was made of her personnel file, and it was found that the beneficiary form was not contained therein. It was therefore incumbent upon her children, if they wished to recover that policy, to prove circumstantially that she had, in fact, executed that form, filed it in the personnel office, and that subsequently the personnel office had lost that file. The following evidence was offered to substantiate that circumstantial case. First, the testimony that Mrs. Maris had properly completed the form, naming her children as beneficiaries, and that they had signed, and the witnesses had signed, in fact, as witnesses to that form. Two, the deceased told others she had filed the form. Three, a duplicate form in the hand of deceased was found among her papers after her death. That it was the habit of the deceased to complete duplicate forms in hand prior to typing out the original. That the personnel office holding Mrs. Maris's file had lost the beneficiary forms of at least four of her co-workers. That the deceased's intent at the time of her death was the same as it was at the time the form was executed, and that the husband was husband in name only, that they had not lived together for years, and that he was an alcoholic. Vital links in that evidentiary chain, that circumstantial chain, were cut in the courts below. The first that was cut was testimony that other personnel files had been lost. It was held inadmissible in the trial court as irrelevant, and in the Court of Appeals, it was held that it was relevant evidence, however, that it was hearsay.
How about the weighing that the trial court concluded that even though perhaps relevant, that the prejudicial effect outweighed its probative value?
Right. One of the other grounds in the Court of Appeals, Justice Gonzalez, was that. And the lack of trustworthiness, I apologize. Did you say lack of trustworthiness or did you say undue prejudice?
Undue prejudice.
Undue prejudice is an extraordinary remedy that's reserved for very special cases, and this is not one of those. All evidence, hopefully, is prejudicial. It's only when it becomes unduly so that it should be excluded. The evidence in this case was very direct. Each of the witnesses said, I personally inspected my file, and the form was not contained therein. That's clearly not hearsay, and there were several cases that I cited in the brief on page 9 in that regard, as well as several cases showing when extraordinary circumstances existed. For instance, in the wrongful death of a child, evidence that the father had some months after the child had been electrocuted shot and killed someone was held unduly prejudicial. Even in the notes of the advisory committee in the federal rules under Rule 803, it specifically states, while this is probably not hearsay, we want to lay the matter to rest. So even the propounders of 803.7 realized that probably was not hearsay evidence. Next.
How long did the parties live together?
Some months, Judge. I did not try the case, but as I remember the statement of facts, just say 6 months.
What was the evidence in the trial court as to the husband's being a spousal and sexual abuser of the children?
There was no evidence, Judge. If you'll look at the statement of facts, I would say that probably 80% of the testimony was by way of bill of review.
Didn't this directly reflect that the son, who was 15 at the time of this marriage, moved out of the house when he was 15 as a result of the presence of the stepfather?
I apologize, Your Honor, but I can't answer that question. I do not know.
Well, there was a handwritten and signed designation of the beneficiary found among her papers, is that right?
Yes.
Well, now, is this, you mentioned that there was evidence that this was a habit of hers to write things out for a form of the...
Yes.
Was this particular piece that was offered in evidence and was excluded from evidence, or was it an exact copy of the form that is provided by the government for beneficiary designation?
Yes, Judge.
Exact in every particular, except it was handwritten instead of printed.
That's correct.
So the parts that were printed on the printed form were hand copied.
Yes.
And then the blanks were filled in.
Yes.
So in every way they matched.
So far as I know, in every way they matched.
Was the original of that form introduced?
The original handwritten form? Yes, Judge.
So it was actually reported to be in her handwriting.
Yes, as a matter of fact, the testimony is on the handwriting of Mrs. Maris was a statement of facts 45 and at 90, and that it was her habit to fill out the forms in hand was at 46, 66, and 91, and that the form was found among her papers was at 35 and 36. Okay. There is a very recent case, I believe the rehearing was denied November the 28th of 1990, from our Court of Criminal Appeals, sitting in Bonk in Madden versus State, 799 Southwest 2nd, 683. They had an analogous situation before them. A murder victim's widow found a handwritten list made by the decedent of all weapons owned by him, including the serial numbers for those weapons. The state introduced the list to show circumstantially that the victim owned the guns in question. The court held the list admissible under Texas Rules of Civil Evidence 803.15, even though the court acknowledged this. The court at page 698 said, "We conclude Exhibit 8 was admissible as a statement affecting an interest in property, although it was not a legally executed document such as a mortgage. First, the document is a list of the weapons which Herbert owned and their corresponding serial numbers, thus indicating his interest in the property. Secondly, the document bears more than an adequate indicia of reliability. Jewell authenticated the document by testifying that the list was definitely in Herbert's handwriting and that the list was among his personal papers, just as in the case at bar."
Counsel, there's no question but that the statute itself requires the document to be actually filed at some point, is it?
No. As a matter of fact, I think it says,
whether or not it's filed is the ultimate issue.
No.
It's not. Okay.
No. As I understand it, it's a document that purports to affect an interest in property. And purport...
I believe he's talking about the statute.
I'm talking about this case.
Oh, in this case, yes. The question is whether or not it was actually filed.
And the evidence that was not considered by the trial court of the other employees who say they had filed this designation of beneficiary, was there ever any direct evidence offered by way of bill of exception that there had actually been filed and then lost, or merely that it was not on file?
The testimony by bill of exception was from witnesses that they actually saw the typed form with Donna Maris's signature on it, and that they had in fact witnessed those documents there in the office.
That evidence was admitted, wasn't it?
I apologize. What, Judge?
That evidence was admitted. The evidence that the witnesses...
I believe that's correct.
And I'm talking about the other four employees who, the evidence that was not admitted, that their designation was lost. Was there any evidence that theirs had ever been filed?
Yes. They testified that they had in fact filed their... testified that they had in fact filed their forms, but then subsequently they had checked and found their forms missing. Yes.
If the handwritten designation had actually been filed, would it have been a sufficient designation?
I don't believe that there's any requirement that it be typed.
Well, is there a requirement that it be the form provided by the government?
I can only say that the government provides those forms, and it's the form we contend Donna Ann Maris used.
The handwritten copy was on a government form.
The handwritten copy was on a government form.
Had it been witnessed?
No.
Because it was her draft.
No, that's right. And so therefore, it would have had to have been witnessed before filing.
Any other questions? Thank you, Tim. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. David Stubblefield will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, your honors, I would first like to address the point of reversible error here. If all of these three items of evidence had been admitted in this case, we have evidence that the Department of Labor lost one of the three types of forms for four different employees out of some 600 employees just in the Dallas office of the Department of Labor alone. We have evidence that the decedent completed a handwritten draft of a document, which there is evidence in the record that that document was later typed and signed and witnessed. That is not the issue here. And there is evidence that the decedent wanted her children, in 1987 at least, to receive the benefits of this life insurance. If all of the evidence to which objections are raised, if it were all admitted, we would have established those three points. But what evidence is there that this lady ever filed the designation of beneficiary form? That was the issue in the trial court. Not whether she wanted to, not whether she took steps to, but whether or not it was actually filed. No one saw her file it. There was testimony that in her personal effects was found a file marked copy of her designation of unpaid compensation form. There was found a file marked copy of her designation of beneficiary of retirements form. But there was no file marked copy of this form. She didn't have the file marked copy. The Department of Labor didn't have the file marked copy. No one ever saw it filed. No one ever saw it lost. There is absolutely no evidence on that point.
But there is evidence that it was typed and that it was witnessed.
Yes. There was evidence. Mr. Downs testified that he signed a designation of beneficiary form. He believed it was. He was not positive, but that is evidence. that he did sign the form and witness it, and he believed that Mr. Perkins also witnessed the form. But what happened to it after they signed it and witnessed it is not known.
What do you mean nobody saw it lost?
There's, for example, Judge, there's no testimony that her personnel file was lost from the Department of Labor.
But we're not talking about the file, we're talking about an item in the file.
Yes, Your Honor. And granted, there is no way to offer direct proof of the loss unless you have an employee of the Department of Labor say, I lost the form. That would be direct proof.
That would never happen.
Well, as a practical matter, you're right, Judge.
Counsel, why isn't it error to exclude the testimony of the four other employees who gave testimony that they, in fact, filed their designation beneficiary and that later on examination they were not contained, they were not on file, and therefore lost? Why isn't that some evidence to question the integrity of the filing system?
We have three reasons why that evidence was not proper and should not have been allowed and should not be allowed at this stage. First is the relevancy question. I raised this in my briefs. Justice Charles Ben Howe said he thought it was relevant, but Rule 403 kept to that on that ground. Under all of those cases on this...
unduly prejudicial.
Right.
In a bench trial.
Right. But my argument is, under relevance, this evidence, if it was admitted, had to have made more likely a fact of consequence in the action. Now, whether or not the Department of Labor lost the forms of other people is not of consequence in this action.
It does tend to show that they may have lost the form of this woman in this instance.
They are attempting to show that by inference, not by circumstantial evidence.
Isn't that a reasonable inference?
A reasonable inference has to be more likely than less likely. There's plenty of case law that says unless you reach that point, it's no evidence. Now, they would have had to call at least half of the employees of the Department of Labor to show it's more likely than less likely that they lost this lady's form. That's the reason why the cases have always held other acts evidence is not admissible.
So it takes a popularity poll to determine.
If you are attempting to do something by inference such as this, it's not a popularity because it's not opinion, but it would be more of a scientific analysis if that's what they're trying to do. I don't agree that that would be a proper means of proving this in this case, but they're attempting to establish by inference a second inference. First inference was that she filed the form in the first place, and trying to stack on top of that an inference that after she filed it, the Department of Labor lost it.
Could you tell the court what additional documents were lost from her file in addition to this beneficiary designation?
This is the only document allegedly lost. There was found in the file the designation of her retirement benefits beneficiary and her unpaid compensation benefits beneficiary.
And those particular forms named the children as beneficiaries.
That's correct, Judge.
And they would have been filed simultaneously with this other document? Or?
Not necessarily. There was testimony from Mr. Downs and Mr. Perkins that they witnessed two of these three documents at the same time. Mr. Perkins did not remember which ones they were. Mr. Downs thought it was the unpaid compensation and life insurance.
Were the three documents on file filed concurrently?
We don't know about the third document. The two documents that were on file...
I'm sorry, there were two that were on file and one that was the one involved here that was missing.
My best recollection is that it does not show a date on the filing stamp. I'm not positive on that, Judge.
Was her statement that she had filed the documents admitted?
No, and that is one statement that I would acknowledge would have had or could have had some effect on the trier of fact in this case, if a statement from the decedent that, yes, I did file that form with the Department of Labor, if that would be an admissible statement, but that was not, and that is just rank hearsay. There's no question it's undisputed and admitted in the trial court and in the briefs that that is a hearsay statement. The question is there an exclusion, an exception to the hearsay rule? And 803.3 specifically says that a statement of memory or belief cannot be admitted to show the fact remembered or believed. Now, in their brief, the petitioners have...
Just before you move on, do you concede that the evidence shows here that the decedent never intended for your client to get the money?
No, Judge. The evidence that was offered was in 1987 she intended her children to receive it.
So the answer is yes, there is no evidence she intended for your client to get the money.
No, the evidence I think goes the contrary way. The evidence shows that these parties were married in July of 1981. The evidence shows that this document, the designation of beneficiary forms on the other compensation, was filed in September of 81 while these parties were living together. Now, the statements offered by the decedent were made 6 years later that she wanted her children to receive her life insurance.
Was there evidence in the record that your client used to beat this woman?
There was, no, I don't believe that there was any evidence that he used to beat the woman. There was a statement made by the son, and granted, the son and the stepfather did not get along. But there were statements made in there that, kind of conclusory statements that he was abusive to her. There was very few exceptions raised to those because they were really not relevant to the case before the trial court.
I may be confusing this case with another one, but wasn't there a last-minute effort on the part of some of the members of the family assisting the dying person to file a new, or to see if one was properly filed or something? Wasn't that kind
yes,
of
yes, Your Honor.
Time?
The decedent's mother called the Department of Labor, found out that these other two forms were on file and the life insurance form was not on file. She then asked them to Federal Express down to Houston, where this woman was in a hospital, a copy of that form so it could be completed. The form did not get there until after she passed away. So they...
But was there evidence that the decedent had tried to, had expressed a desire to sign a new form?
There was evidence offered, Judge, and that being...
But that was excluded.
Well, what the evidence was an actual document she signed that was a blanket, I declare that any policy of insurance that I have, I want my children to receive it. But it's undisputed that that is not sufficient under the federal statute because it was not filed with the Department of Labor prior to her death.
Can I ask you about internal operating procedure of the Department of Labor? They obviously have several forms that every employee is obligated to complete. This was one of them. Since the form was never filed, what steps were taken by the Department of Labor to follow up to determine who the beneficiary should be?
I don't know, Judge, that you have to, it's an obligation that you file these forms. I think it's a right that you have to designate your beneficiary. The federal statutes provide what happens if you don't designate your beneficiary. And if a person had a spouse they were living with and wanted to receive it, they might just not designate the beneficiary. So I don't think the Department of Labor takes any affirmative steps to force you to file the forms, if that's what you're referring to.
Do they request that you file the forms?
I don't know that there is any request. There was a statement made by a witness, and I'm not that familiar with the practices of the Department of Labor. There is a statement in the record to the effect that I filed my form during a grace period during some year or something like that. I don't know what he meant by that.
How long did this couple actually live together?
The statements in the record are 6 to 8 months.
And they were legally married for about 7 years.
Yes, Judge.
And the son, who was at that time 15, must have moved out very shortly after the marriage because I believe, doesn't the record reflect it, they continued to live together for about 6 months after the son moved out. Must have been pretty quickly.
I don't recall that from the record. To the contrary, I believe the son said 5 months was his testimony of the length of time they lived together. I don't recall when he said he moved out.
On this deathbed designation that never was filed, had that been filed, would that have been a sufficient under the federal rules at the time?
It was notarized.
It was notarized.
And
if it had been filed in time, would it have been a sufficient designation?
I don't know, but I don't know why it would not have been, because I don't think the federal statute requires a particular form. It just requires a designation of beneficiary be signed, witnessed, and filed before death. So I don't know why it would not have been, but that was not the point that we were briefing, so...
But the clock ran out just before it was filed. It was after, it had been, in every way it was complete except it did not actually get into the file before she died. Is that the thing that makes the difference?
There is no evidence that anyone ever intended it to get into the file. In other words...
Well, they were trying very hard to get it prepared and everything before she died.
They were trying to get it signed, but I don't know whether or not they would have taken those extra steps to go back to Dallas and file it.
Were they under the impression that just getting it signed was all that was required?
I have no idea, Judge.
There's no evidence?
There's no evidence, and there would have to be evidence to speculate on that.
Well, you concede that the record contains clear and unequivocal evidence of the deceased's intent that her children receive proceeds of that insurance.
In 1987, Judge, yes, I did.
Before she died, there's clear, unequivocal expression evidence of her intent in the record. It wasn't filed. There's no evidence that it was filed.
That's right, Judge, because we offered no evidence to the contrary, so therefore it was undisputed.
Up to the time of her death, there was an expressed intent on her part, both verbally, which was not admitted, but in writing, which was admitted, that they be the beneficiaries.
That is correct, Judge, but I would point out that if such a deathbed execution of this document would have been sufficient in this case, it is possible that we would have, because that was a fact and issue, called her doctor as a witness, because there's evidence that she was in a coma up until the day before she died. She came out, signed this document, and went back in. It's possible that she did not have the requisite mental facilities to sign the thing. We don't know. We did not even try to offer any proof on that point.
So basically, we're not talking about intent here. We're talking about whether something was filed.
That's right.
Pursuant to a federal statute.
That's right. Now, under the federal statute, the federal cases, it doesn't matter what her intent was at the time she allegedly tried to fill the thing out. The federal statute says intent is not an issue. It's whether or not she filed it. Now, the intent evidence was offered for the limited purpose of showing that she intended, and this was the argument, she intended in 1987 to have her children get it, so therefore she had not changed her mind. And I would point out that this evidence was admitted by the trial court at page 61 and 62 for this limited purpose.
But the overall intent, if we can glean one of this person, as shown by the various forms that she did sign and file, was that she wanted her children to be her basic beneficiary.
In 87, yes, Judge.
Right. And is there anything in there where she designated her husband, your client, as her beneficiary?
No, Your Honor.
So putting those two things together, if we can glean her intent, it seems to be inescapable. But it was that she wanted her children to be the beneficiary. And so we're again down to the point of whether or not that intent was evidenced in a way by which it could be filed and put in her personnel file and whether it could have been lost or not.
In 87, there's no dispute. But we don't know if this woman knew for those 6 years preceding 87 that her surviving spouse would receive that insurance if she didn't file it. If
I'm
she knew
about
that.
Whether she knew what would happen if she didn't do it. I'm talking about her intent.
If she knew what would happen, then obviously her intent was that her surviving spouse get it, or she would have filed the form.
What kind of communication, since their estrangement, had the husband and wife had in this case?
The testimony in the record, Judge, from the surviving spouse was, I forgot the phrase he used, that they were on good speaking terms. And then the daughter testified that they were like associates. The son said they were on bad terms.
I have copies of the exhibits that were admitted into evidence. The designation of beneficiary for unpaid compensation stated 9/24/81. There was an earlier 1980 date that had been scratched through. That was admitted into evidence. That was on file. Is that correct?
Yes, Judge.
Then you have designation of beneficiary for civil service retirement benefits. same date, September 24th, 1981, with an earlier date that's been scratched through, and that was excluded from evidence for what reason?
I don't recall if it was later allowed or not, Judge. It was not allowed.
Then we have a handwritten form, a designation beneficiary federal employee group life insurance program, which has a handwritten date, August 1980, which designates the children, which was excluded from evidence, then it's not file marked. Like these other two copies, these were file mark copies. They apparently got from the files, from her personal papers that had the, they were file mark copies. She had in the personal possession of the other beneficiary designations. But she had no file mark copy of this beneficiary designation, but it's not disputed that it's in her handwriting.
I believe the testimony was that the two typed copies were filed in her record she had taken home from the office, and the handwritten draft was filed, was found in the desk in her office. They were not found in the same place.
But there's no copy of anything anywhere, assuming that this had been filed, that would have changed, showing that there was a change in beneficiary to her husband, was there?
No, Judge.
Any other questions? Thank you, sir.
May it please the court, Mr. Sibley will now present the rebuttal argument for the petitioner.
Mr. Sibley, what can you point us to that would demonstrate that but for the exclusion of this evidence that the trial court here in a bench trial as the sole fact finder would have made a different decision?
Well, you know, I was really hoping that you wouldn't use those words, because I know there are some opinions out there that say but for is the reversible error standard. However, this court, Texas Power and Light versus Herring, Golden versus Odeorn, Dallas Railway and Terminal versus Bailey, Pittman versus Valadez, and King versus Shelley, I hope had put to rest that but for. I hope the test is that that such an error, a reversible error, amounts to such a denial of the rights of appellant as was reasonably calculated to cause and probably did cause rendition of an improper judgment, or probably prevented the appellate court from making a proper presentation of his case to the appellate court. And if we use the standard that has been advocated by Reagan Simpson and Mike Hatchell and some of the other writers in the area of reversible error, they would say that the Supreme Court has translated the above phrases into the following. That reverse error is that error that is more likely that it caused than not the error complained of. That there's more reason to believe it caused than not. That there's more evidence for causation than against it. And it contributed in a substantial way to bring about an unjust result.
Well, in this bench trial, how was the Bill of Exceptions made in the presence of the very judge who decided the facts ultimately contrary to your client?
That's correct. And if you're asking inferentially, if the judge had allowed all the evidence in and then ruled against the children, would there have been error? I don't know, but I'm certain that we would have been on far less shaky, on far more shaky ground. However, I think it's quite clear when you read the record that he excluded that evidence and that he did not take it into consideration. And if we hold the following three things, that the exclusion of a piece of evidence was error, and I believe that the exclusion of all three of these we can say was error, and that the court could have rendered a different verdict if it had considered that excluded evidence, and that the exclusion of the evidence probably had an effect on the court's judgment, and I think quite clearly it did, then I think each one of these was a vital link and that each one of them constituted reversible error. I think one more reason for the admission of the witnesses' statements, and remember now, there may be 800 employees in the Department of Labor, but we're talking about her little office and only four people in her little office having lost those forms. In 8037, the absence of entry and records kept in accordance with the provisions of paragraph 6 says
unless the sources of information or other circumstances indicate a lack of trustworthiness. And certainly that other forms had been lost by four other employees goes to the trustworthiness of the record keeper.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument. In the first call, the court will take a brief recess.
Your Honor, please rise.